This is a Radical Exchange production.
Hello, I am joined in this episode by Brent Hecht and Joe Goldie. Brent is a professor of computer science at Northwestern and a director of applied science at Microsoft. Joe Goldie is a professor of history at SMU and a senior fellow with the Radical Exchange Foundation. The seed for this conversation was the question of whether Google's index of pages should be understood as a form of public infrastructure, and if so, why. It ended up being a wide-ranging discussion that surfaced ideas about how we can get smarter about the boundary between public and private power by getting smarter about what's infrastructure and what isn't. This could hardly be more relevant as investments in public infrastructure are dominating conversation in the United States. But perhaps we need to broaden our view from physical infrastructure to informational infrastructure, which might indeed be even more important. I hope you enjoy this conversation. I am Matt Pruitt, and this is Radical Exchanges with Brent Hecht and Joe Goldie.
I studied with somebody who was into the built environment at Harvard, and then I was so enchanted with that world that I enrolled in a PhD program at Cambridge. I was the geography PhD, and then I enrolled in an architecture PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, just as that department was collapsing, and half of us went to history and half of us went to geography, and I wound up with a history PhD. Nobody in the history department had any idea why everything was a map, everything was about maps, everything was about reality. Like, what?
Well, we can nerd out about that. You know, I love maps are a wonderful reference system upon which we can organize an enormous amount of knowledge. I will say that, like, to transition us into this discussion, it's, I think, not random that two people who are refugees from the field of geography found ourselves talking about this topic, you know, today. Like, I credit my geographic education with allowing me to have what has ended up being foresight with regards to the biggest problems in computing. You know, geography is a field that eschews abstractions, right? It talks about the first law of geography is everything is related to everything else, but near things are more related than distant things. Usually we pay attention to that latter part because it helps us define our statistical methods and these types of things. But the first part's super, super important. And it's an explicit rejection of abstraction, which is a core principle of computer science. And that is being able to think outside of the abstractions that computing has created or created, you know, 2005, 2010, when I was doing my graduate education. You know, that has allowed us to get some empirical data in front of decision makers, in front of people who are interested in trying to you know, bend the arc of societal impact of the tech industry towards something more positive, you know, when they're ready for those questions versus sort of scrambling afterwards.
So, Brent, I want to push even further on that, because I find that this idea of eschewing abstraction comes up more and more when I talk to people who are interested in bending the arc of the computing industry in an attractive direction. I'm curious if you can say a little bit more about what that means to you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I actually recall, so I'm one of the founding members of the FACT, ACM FACT Executive Committee, which has been a wild and just amazingly joyful isn't the right word, amazingly meaningful experience. It also is joyful. But, you know, that community is emerging as, you know, the primary or a primary publication oriented community in responsible AI, and, you know, increasingly is interested in the topics that Radical Exchange is interested in. And in 2018, I was in a workshop that preceded that conference where we kind of got into this. I started playing around with a provocation I use a bunch, which is abstraction the original sin of computer science? is that why we got ourselves into this mess? And, you know, a vigorous debate ensued. The provocation was successful just because it's challenging a core principle that we teach. You know, when I taught my, you know, 200, 300 person, you know, intro programming class, that was, you know, a key topic we discussed, a vigorous debate. And then some of my colleagues followed up on that with an amazing paper that, you know, we can put in the podcast notes or whatnot, really unpacked, you know, some of the challenges that abstraction, you know, causes to computer science. So folks are interested in reading that in more detail, you know, they can look at that paper. You know, broadly speaking, though, like we've trained several generations of computer scientists to only think within the, you know, very specific box and quite explicitly say that the other things are not their problems. And that's why you get well-known computer scientists in industry and in academia saying things like, well, what effect will this have on income inequality? Or even worse, like assuming that they know the effect that it'll have, and it's going to be positive because of what, you know, it can't possibly be anything else, and I don't need to, you know, crack a book or anything to try to figure out any any complexities along those lines. It's because, you know, like that's a principle to sort of everyone sort of stays engineering wise, everyone's supposed to stay in their own lane. And that has, you know, to extend the analogy too much, that lane has taken us those lanes have taken us to a place that I think the three of us find very concerning.
I agree with everything that Brent is saying, and I'll just add to that. This morning I was in a conference of digital historians who were talking about the study of 19th century newspapers. They had computer scientists among them, and the same debate was going on there. Neural nets can imitate. They can imitate our photos. They can imitate our writing. They can pretend to be humans very effectively. But can you ask a neural net to analyze Shakespeare and tell you, have a conversation with you about what's distinctive about Shakespeare? Can you ask the neural net to show you its homework and what features of Shakespeare it was analyzing when it makes that assessment? That's much more difficult. And there's a lot of frustration in that community of people who are interested in text analysis, in a level of abstraction that is so abstract from the text, so abstract from the actual data, that it can be a challenge. So in a conversation about infrastructure, you started off by talking about the map. The map is kind of the primordial infrastructure. You draw a T and an O, and look, it's the rivers of creation and the major continents. It's Europe and Asia and Africa. That's the original T-O map. Anybody who's seen a logo for the subway system or for the toll road has seen some rendition of that map. The map is an infrastructure for thinking about the big categories that make up our world. And they're real categories. It really is a Europe and an Asia and an Indian Ocean, as symbolized by that map. So this conversation is about the kinds of infrastructures that matter today. And we should probably be as concrete as possible. What is infrastructure today? What is the infrastructure in the 21st century? Is it wires? Is it all programs? Brent, do you have a definition of infrastructure?
Oh boy, that's interesting. You know, from a computing standpoint, you know, it's almost like infrastructure. It's infrastructure all the way down, like it's turtles all the way down. So, you know, it actually closely ties in with what we were saying about abstraction, right? So one reason why abstraction is important is everyone can kind of focus on their own layer of a technology. And then as long as folks know the interface between the layer they're working on and the next layer, the layer on top of it, then, you know, everything's great. All of the information that's possibly needed can pass through that interface. And then, you know, we're building infrastructure on top of infrastructure on top of infrastructure. And I think one reason why abstraction can cause so many problems is then you have like this compounding means by which certain considerations are not taken into account that can have just ripple effects, you know, throughout the tech ecosystem. So to use the example that you were just talking about, one piece of infrastructure that's increasingly important is, you know, what Google calls the knowledge graph, what other companies call usually different types of graphs. And actually, you know, with regards to geographic applications, you know, this is for me, you know, one of the smaller problems with infrastructure and computing right now, but it is still a problem. There's an assumption, these systems are designed, so they've created abstractions such that there is a great deal of certainty associated with things that don't have that degree of certainty. So an example actually that Evgeny Gavrilovich at Google talked about, you know, a number of years ago with regards to the knowledge graph was like, does every country have one capital, right? So like you assume like, yes, that's the case. But in fact, the notion of a capital is blurred or problematized in at least two countries. and that creates, you know, then downstream, you know, if you're using the knowledge graph as infrastructure, you know, how do you do inference on top of that? You know, what's the capital of South Africa? Well, you have to explain something outside of the simple, you know, one-to-one mapping abstraction, you know, something similar in Bolivia as well. So yes, I've been talking a lot. I should pass things off to the next person who's going to define infrastructure. So I think that's you, Matt. Well,
this is a, I think we can do more to, you know, come up with a really useful definition of infrastructure here. But first, I want to resolve an interesting thing that has emerged, which is that on the one hand, we're saying abstraction just something to worry about. On the other hand, we're saying that infrastructure is good. Okay. And then we're also saying that maps are infrastructure, but maps are also abstractions,
yes, they are.
Right? So in a way, a map is like the perfect illustration of what an abstraction is. So, okay. So what are we really trying to say here? Are we saying, you know, do we want to make our abstractions more accurate, or do we want to resist the temptation to turn everything into abstractions?
Super good question, Matt.
So it helps to pay attention to what the words used to mean. And this is something that I know because of the Yale map historian, Bill Rankin, who wrote about this in his wonderful History of 20th Century Maps and how different map making comes in the era of the satellite. Bill says that infrastructure was first a French word, and it was a French word from Marxists. He used it to play on the Marxist term superstructure. So a superstructure is an ideology, and it's distinct from a base. The base is all of the kinds of exchanges that make some people rich, which make some people investors, which leave other people poor. So you have a superstructure on top of it that's ideology. And then you have infrastructure. And infrastructure is what happens when the ideology channels certain kinds of capital into structures. So that could be the road system or the train system or the factories. They're actually heavy. They take a long time to build. They tend not to go away. They tend to have some resistance in time. So the house that I build today, you know, 20 families could move into my house 10 years from now, but it continues to structure who gets to live where capital is invested for a long time. So an infrastructure is, yeah, I think Matt is really, really, really clever in drawing our attention to the fact that an infrastructure, like a map, can be simultaneously an abstraction and something very concrete, something linked to the world that's in the nature of this material world around it.
But we could look at a map as infrastructure to the extent that it's like a common resource that a bunch of people are using, right?
Yeah.
Other examples of infrastructure, like a network of roads, seem a little different to me than a map, right? Now, you could look at a network of roads as a map, but when a network of roads emerges to connect people for some, you know, to connect settlements for some useful purpose, it's not initially conceived of as an abstraction in the same way that a map is.
Well, this might get a little bit too pedantic, but I think if looking through the infrastructural lens and thinking about what types of abstractions infrastructure creates and infrastructure affords, I think they're more similar. So with regards to, you know, maps are designed as infrastructure for specific purposes, right? So you know, I'm looking, Joe has a map behind her. That's a design probably for more artistic or historical purposes. You know, we use Google Maps designed for, you know, specific purposes. And it's great infrastructure for, you know, many of those purposes in many cases. With regards to roads, it's somewhat similar, right? So like there are certain, you know, I'm thinking about infrastructure through a computer scientist lens, and there are certain interfaces that a road creates, right? And certain assumptions that are made behind those interfaces. So we, you know, for instance, here in Washington, there aren't a lot of sidewalks next to the roads. And so they're just assuming that roads are for cars. And in other places, you know, roads are designed for all sorts of different purposes. And, you know, there's a lot of cleverness that goes, like, one thing that roads are designed for is like safe, even in the interstate, right? It's designed for safe travel at a reasonable speed for automobiles. And like it's really well, like actually there's an argument that one of the most important public health measures that we've ever undertaken as a country is the interstate and all the innovations they have. Like the curves on interstates are designed intentionally to increase safety, and interstate itself dramatically reduced the number of people who died in automobile accidents. But it like, you know, it's confounded in certain ways when those abstractions fail, right? So, you know, people can't travel from point A to point B if there's a protest on the road, you know, these types of things, in the same way that I can't tell, you know, I don't have a good view into some aspects of the human geography of the places I've lived just by looking at Google Maps. I don't understand, you know, average age, other demographics, economics of the area, which can really help me get to know the area and the lived experiences of the people who occupy, you know, the various regions. So actually, there's a view that both of these are infrastructure upon which you, that assume certain purposes and upon which we can build more infrastructure or take take specific actions.
Okay, I'm sold. So roads are infrastructure and roads are also abstractions.
Roads, yes, or roads make abstractions in the same way that, that maps make abstractions. You know, Matt, I think you're making a more important point, though, which is, yeah, so maybe decide if we want to leave that a more philosophical discussion in there. But the more important point is, yes, you're exactly right. In you know, I'm primarily interested in making computing less harmful, making an AI paradigm that produces fewer harms. And I should say this is from a net standpoint and more benefits, right, for a very large group of people. And this is when I talk in my responsible AI course back at Northwestern, right, this is something I talk about. Chances are, doing exactly what we've been doing is not the optimal solution. Chances are throwing out everything and saying we're not going to use computer science anymore, that's not going to be the optimal solution in terms of creating net benefits, right? It's going to be somewhere in the middle, right? So, and therein lies the joy and the quest and the challenge, right, is trying to figure out in a detailed way, usually, thinking through all the problems and thinking through how we might mitigate all of those problems and designing a system that works better for more people. So with regard to maps, for instance, like there is an amazing set of best practices, many of which, you know, can be ignored by people outside the field, but there is an amazing set of best practices going from everything from the map projection you use for a specific purpose you know, for instance, when you're talking about thematic maps or what are commonly known as heat maps, ways to make sure that the reader, you're not accidentally or intentionally lying to the map reader in terms of the spatial distributions that are trying to be visualized. And that took a long time and a lot of research and then a lot of teaching and a lot more research. But I'm generally speaking quite optimistic that we can do that with some of the problems that radical change is interested in.
So Joe, how would you define infrastructure, if we wanted to zoom in on this and come up with a workable definition, and what would you say?
Well, I'd say that one of the key features of infrastructure is that it's connective and that it has a material reality. So we could fancifully say that something like Western philosophy is an infrastructure that allows certain kinds of thought. But let's say that infrastructure has to be a material object, and it has to be something that connects other people. So the infrastructures of the past that made enormous innovations include the grid system, laying out your city in a grid as the easiest way to plot land, to sell land, to make land fungible so you can grow a city on the frontier. Lay down road networks and you can connect an economy. You lay down subways or trains. You can speed up the time of exchanges. And then now you have a conceptual problem, which is, so what about other things that speed up exchanges? So something like the post office. The post office and infrastructure, it's not the same thing as a road network. Well, the post office also requires buildings. It requires physical post offices where there are letter sorters. They have maps and they have zip codes. They've got a knowledge infrastructure that helps them to divide up all of those zip codes. And then they have actual mail trucks. So sure, that's an infrastructure. What about the stock exchange? That speeds up exchanges. Well, the stock exchange also has physical systems of connectivity. So if you've ever seen the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, there's that scene where he's in front of an old TRS-80 computer and he's gazing into the terminal and he's seeing the numbers of stock prices flicker. And the point is that even in the 1980s, if you wanted to be a great stock exchange person, you needed an information infrastructure, and some part of that was physical. The physical connection where you could get those prices of exchange, that was part of what made you a trader, made you somebody serious that you had to deal with, was that you were physically at the point where you could get the information about the stock exchanges in a more quick fashion. So what does that tell us about our own time? That means we would want to pay attention to the kinds of infrastructure that are enabling exchanges or more rapid exchanges today, and we'd be interested in some of the physical connections that make that possible. So that kind of infrastructure usually falls onto a heading of broadband or net neutrality or the undersea wire system that connects some places on the globe better than other places. If you have a bad fortune to be a former colony, you probably have less access to the undersea network of connections. And maybe that's something that Brent can tell us about. But then we have other kinds of half material infrastructures that enable other kinds of exchanges. And these include the online world of portals that make maps available. Now, this is a little confusing because it partakes of both the material and the immaterial. If I've got a heat map from Google of all of the places nearby where I can order a taco heat map, is that infrastructure? Well, it's a taco infrastructure. It helps my exchange of tacos, my exchange of money for tacos go more rapidly, which is very important to the quality of my life. On the other hand, it depends on this other infrastructure of wires and broadband, which is mostly managed by private and semi-public entities, which allow us to be connected. So this begs important questions about what an infrastructure is and how we make those exchanges happen more rapidly when you have something like the Google search index, which indexes all of those taco shops and tells me what the best one is. The Google index is a private index. It's a kind of knowledge infrastructure. It's held in one place. Google made it. Google provides it. It helps me find my local taco shop. But it's owned privately, unlike the system of roads or sidewalks or the post office or many other infrastructures in the past, which have enabled more rapid exchanges. And so Matt and I got interested and started having a conversation that we invited Brent into after about a month ago. The New York Times published an article about the Google Index and some of the activists in Silicon Valley who have started to make an argument about how the Google Index, it should not be something that Google has the power to exclude other search engines from. Should an infrastructure be private? Should an infrastructure be public and shared? And is the Google Index indeed an infrastructure? So that's what we wanted to talk about today. And I would just say provocatively, maybe Brent will agree with this or push back on it, but as a starting position, let me say that the Google Index is very much like a map. It has the same effects as materiality. You can build other things on top of it. It makes other exchanges possible. You have to be connected to it in order for those exchanges to work. Is the Google Index an infrastructure? Yes. And at the moment, it's a private infrastructure. And so that brings us into another subject of conversation, which is the history of infrastructure, public and private. How do they work? And this is a big topic of debate and argument among economists and historians and other people who care about exchanges. Should your sidewalk be public or private? Should your road system be run on toll roads or public roads? Should you have a public interstate highway system? Should you have net neutrality and broadband that's operated in the interests of everyone? So next up, should the Google Index be privately held or a public infrastructure?
It's a really good question, you know, Joe, I'm already enjoying learning a lot from you. One thing I'd say is, like, from a computer scientist standpoint, and your knowledge of this, you know, the theory behind this, you know, exceeds mine. And I think that's actually critical that we as computer scientists listen to you and folks like yourself, given how much you can teach us. But I can just tell you sort of the experience of a computer scientist who's spent a bit of time as a practitioner and then also, you know, as a researcher. The way I view infrastructure is, you know, anything I need to rely on to you know, get my current job done. And in that way, one can make the argument actually that computer science is in some ways like one of the more infrastructure dependent or infrastructure focused fields, you know, that are out there. I have to think that, you know, that I won't stick by that bet my you know, my salary on that or anything, but it, you know, it is interesting to think, like, any like my thesis, for instance, dozens and dozens and dozens of and if you go all the way down to like the ones and zeros, so many people, you know, contributed to the infrastructure that I relied on to add a little bit of knowledge you know, to the world now and increasing the number of years ago. So the, you know, the short answer is, like, yes, anything that you can build an application on strikes me as infrastructure, and that would include search indices. That would include knowledge graphs. Trivially speaking, that would include the geographic version of the search index, which is you know, Google Maps or Apple Maps or Bing Maps. So yes, for sure. And I'm super excited to hear from you about that means with regards to how we can achieve, you know, as I mentioned, optimal outcomes for society with respect to ownership. One thing I think I maybe want to jump into this conversation, I'm not sure if we'll get to it later, but it's interesting to reflect on Wikipedia in this context. And Wikipedia, speaking of infrastructure, it's the central to my thesis. That's one. It's essential to a huge percentage of people, broadly speaking, the AI world's theses and their research and the products they build, you know, more generally. And that is, it's not publicly owned, but it is a nonprofit and it is created by volunteers. And I've always been intrigued by the distribution of resources and concerned about the distribution of resources between those who rely on Wikipedia as infrastructure and the folks who maintain that infrastructure and the non-optimal outcomes that may be a result.
So one thing that I would like to throw out into the open, because it's sort of a subtext that we all probably have that listeners may not, is, you know, there's, when we say something is infrastructure, there's a little bit of a hidden implication that it should be in some sense then controlled by the public, right? You know, and then there's a whole array of interesting conversations to have about what that looks like. Like, what does it actually mean for control over infrastructure to be broadly distributed in the proper way? And there are very different conceptions of this, and the differences between the different conceptions matter a lot.
Yeah.
But in the context of Wikipedia, one thing I wanted to ask you, Brent, about is, so Wikipedia has made itself open to anyone who wants to use it in quite a radical way, and has created an enormous amount of value that we have all enjoyed, me more than most. I think I've got to be in the in the most intensive group of Wikipedia users over the past 20 years or something. But at the same time, your research points out that there has been sort of a problem of appropriation, private appropriation of the value of this collective resource or this shared resource that Wikipedia represents. And I'm curious, you know, how you evaluate, how do you look at Wikipedia historically at this point? I mean, did they succeed, or did they, you know, can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, how it's been appropriated and how you see that?
Sure. And I'm super curious to, you know, hear from Joe about this too, but I'll try to reflect a bit quickly. Broadly speaking, you know, we were interested in a, you know, a very challenging and important and extremely difficult to address in a short period of time research question, which is, how can we shift some of the power that's concentrating in large tech firms towards a more distributed outcome among the general public? And our hypothesis is this will be broadly very useful for the general public, as well as tech companies, which are currently facing many, many challenges associated with the concentration of power. You know, recent news about Facebook, for instance, concentration of power within you know, their boardrooms and their product teams. And so we decided to start asking this question by focusing on Wikipedia's relationship to a lot of the, you know, the technologies that we use today, and hopefully measuring and making people aware of the value of that infrastructure in the context of this conversation to all of these magical tech products that seem so amazing when you don't know to, you know, open up the hood and see, you know, what kind of infrastructure is inside. Just totally scramble all of our metaphors so far today. And once we measured and made people aware of that value, you know, build tools to help people take collective action around that value, as well as help people understand how that value can help them motivate policy actions. So, for instance, you know, we hope our research will show, and I'll talk a bit about that, you know, now or in another question, show folks that, like, large tech companies are super reliant on this public resource. So it's not all that unreasonable to ask for regulation or to ask for different distribution of the technological dividend and these types of things. And again, our hypothesis is this will make a healthier long-term tech ecosystem, even for the companies So one example study that we did, which I like a lot, is we actually built a Chrome extension that silently hid just Wikipedia links. Like, Wikipedia is super important to all of these AI technologies that are underlying search and underlying information retrieval more generally. And we decided, look, let's start simple. Let's just look at the links that people actually click on. And we built a Chrome extension that hid those, and we had a treatment group and a control group. The treatment group, I'm simplifying a bit, but had essentially used Google without Wikipedia for, really one of the first times, since Google existed. They were born, roughly around the same time. and then we had a control group, to make comparisons against. And what we found is that Google is a much less effective search engine for a large percentage of queries when it can't surface Wikipedia data. It's just like when Google's about addressing user information needs. And ultimately, a lot of the way it does that is just surfacing this infrastructure for people, not doing any sort of real magical AI, with the exception of the relevance assessment and these types of things. But ultimately, people, click on these links. You folks know Nick Vincent. He's done some research trying to understand what percentage of queries are search engines reliant on Wikipedia. And it ends up being like Wikipedia, they're more reliant on Wikipedia than, based on what we can tell, and it's hard to measure these things given that a lot of this is locked up behind closed doors, they're reliant on Wikipedia more than any other piece of infrastructure, content infrastructure on the web. And that to me is, a great way to measure. And then hopefully, through this podcast and other means, making people aware of that relationship between application and in the context of this conversation infrastructure, help them use that as fodder for public policy discussions. And then also, this is an interesting, there's just some news today about this, and I need to read up a bit more before I can talk about it with the expertise that hopefully I'm talking about other things, but it'll also help Wikipedia get the resources it needs to be the best infrastructure it can be.
Yeah.
So that's totally fascinating. The data for Google is public. I mean, you put it in much more precise terms than that. Google uses Wikipedia's data, but it's crowdsourced, human-built data that Google used to make its search results so good.
Yes.
And just to draw that out a little, I mean, the implications of that are enormous. Can you build something private on top of something public? Can I erect my house in the middle of the public highway? No, I would get into lots of trouble if I tried to build a house in the middle of the highway. And it brings up, it also brings to mind Creative Commons copyright. I take a photograph of my favorite taco shack and I put it on Flickr. I can choose how I share it with the public. Do I share it as a private piece of property, intellectual property, and pay me to use it, or is it public? But if it's public, I have all of these options for making it share and share alike. You can use it, but you have to share of it. So what we're learning is that Google has effectively been using publicly shared share and share alike, but they haven't been sharing alike. And that chafes my moral sense of right. I'm not the lawyer. Matt is the lawyer. But it's a question of justice. Many people would be like, wait, you're not supposed to build your house on top of the highway. What are you doing, Google?
Yeah, but I think there's just this interesting question of whether the sort of open source movement made a mistake by allowing commercial use,
Super interesting question.
To illustrate the point that you both have just made vividly, I almost have a distinct memory of somewhere around 2001, 2002, Wikipedia was my homepage. And then I realized that Google searched Wikipedia better than Wikipedia's search function searched Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And then I made Google my homepage. And, this is the basis of the entire empire, basically, right? If Google hadn't been able to build its walls around that house where the primary value of the internet to me was, which is to say Wikipedia, right? If they hadn't been able to swallow that up, I wouldn't have helped to build their index, among other things, right?
I should note, this notion of did the open source movement adequately consider the implications of commercial use? I think it's an interesting question. I actually, after having thought about this for a while, think that it's important for us to be thinking about other approaches or ways that we can try to get some of the benefits of the open source licenses that are available, while at the same time making sure that that doesn't mean we're establishing power structures that exacerbate existing inequalities in power. But I should know that there are going to be many Wikipedians who think of this as a massive success and don't see anything wrong with it, right? That essentially their work was scaled. They created this public infrastructure. And we have to remember, it's not like a forest in which the forest force goes away, right? The data is available to anyone and is infinitely replicable. They created this like permanent forest that, you know, the trees grow right away as soon as they're you know, sawed down. And through that lens, it is amazing, right? So like they can take a lot of pride and a sense of accomplishment in helping to create some of the most amazing technologies that humans have ever created. Where my concern comes in is that, again, I think there are externalities to that relationship that go beyond pride and accomplishment and are becoming more concerning.
Sure. And I, you know, this just goes back to that question of control over infrastructure, right? So if we build these things that lead to other things and that flower and become super amazing, and then we all become reliant on them in the same way that we're reliant on road networks or maps or whatever, The question then arises essentially how we share control over the infrastructure that we all depend on. And this is where it connects back up to the question of abstraction, right? So when we build infrastructure, this, and also when we create abstractions, there are ideologies that go into that in terms of, you know, what we represent on the map or what we don't. And essentially when there's like private or concentrated control over infrastructure, the exact same thing is going on, right? There are particular interests that are being represented in the infrastructure. But, you know, so I'm the first to acknowledge that a lot of people in the open source movement would call that a success. I think I would push back, you know, I think I would argue that in spite of the many amazing things that have happened, part of the picture has been missed in whatever abstraction we were using to evaluate success. And that's what we're trying to deal with, right? We're trying to figure out how to share control over.
Yeah, the analogy from, you know, the old geography days is that, like, you know, the open source movement is building roads. It's only going to empower people who have cars, right? And I feel like we're getting a bit of that dynamic going on with the current today licensing infrastructure. One sort of interesting case, you know, Joe, maybe I'll toss things to you to reflect on this as well, because my biggest question for you actually is like, when is it good for the public to have sort of full control over infrastructure, some kind of a partial control as you know, which models infrastructure are best for which types of outcomes in which context? I'd love to, you know, learn more from you about that. One sort of interesting case here is Google's dependence on Wikipedia. And I should note that Wikipedia is also dependent on Google because of the position everything is in. The paper was called the mutual dependence of Wikipedia and Google, colon, something I can't remember exactly. But the one case that's been concerning me lately is there's a community and a repository of spatial data called OpenStreetMap, and it's very often called the Wikipedia of maps. An incredibly useful data set for all sorts of things. And if you look at the bottom right of some slippy maps that you'll see on the web or on your phone, you'll see, you know, the attribution to OpenStreetMap contributors. It does power a growing number of technologies these days. Their licensing situation is even, well, that's a can of worms we won't open. But Google, which can use OpenStreetMap, you know, if it chooses to, it has historically and is now once again asking people to actually submit edits directly to their map, right? So they're essentially, they have a huge amount of traffic, and that traffic allows them to build better infrastructure, right? So essentially, like, you know, for my wedding, I remember doing this, right? That one of the roads was not correctly encoded on Google Maps to get to the site of my rehearsal dinner. And it put me in this bind because at that point, that was 5+ years ago. It's a good, I can remember that because every year I get an N+1 there. 5+ years ago. And it put me in a bind because I knew that everyone would be using Google Maps as infrastructure to get to where the rehearsal dinner was. But I also was beginning to think deeply about these types of situations. Like, well, wait a second, if I'm going to be doing some work, shouldn't I at least do work into the public, you know, help out the public infrastructure, which is OpenStreetMap. So I actually identified this early on. I edit OpenStreetMap and hope that it propagates to these other platforms. It didn't work. I ended up having to, you know, make a suggestion, you know, for Google Maps, as I recall.
Go ahead. Rehearsal dinner, you were editing OpenStreetMap. You were so concerned, were you, about the public, right? You were on your way to get married and you're not adjusting your bow tie, you're adjusting OpenStreetMap. I mean, mad respect, Brent. That's wonderful.
That was not super far outside of something I would do. In this case, I've noticed it early and was able, like, a couple of months ahead of time. But that is definitely something that would be annoying. I think another way to frame that is you could say, well, Brent, you were working on editing OpenStreetMap instead of, for instance, you know, helping. I had to stay up late to help out with the invitation list and all these types of things as well. But yeah, Joe, teach me and Matt what you're thinking.
Well, let me teach you about what I'm thinking. Give me that beautiful invitation. So I'm somebody who thinks a lot using historical parables. What was infrastructure like in the past? How do we have to regulate it in order to get to the common good in the past? That's how I process most of these. That's going to be my value added. So let me say that, one position that we could find in the past and in the present is a kind of hardcore libertarian approach. The hardcore libertarian approach just disbelieves that we need to have any public repositories for anything because people are selfishly motivated. They need to see that they're having a reward in order to introduce new innovations. And so these people would look at the history of toll roads and say toll roads were a great moment in westward expansion of roads in the early colonial United States. Toll roads were a great moment in building up the infrastructure of the early industrial revolution in Britain. Toll roads are great. We have private companies today that are laying broadband and charging you for the quality, and they should be doing this because this incentivizes them to do it more. Google built infrastructure that nobody else had built. Maybe Wikipedia should be a for-profit service. Maybe that would solve everything. So there's a seed of truth in that, just like there's a seed of truth in everything. But let's look at some of the other models. So another model is sunsetting. So in sunsetting, you take a system of private rights in which you rewarded somebody for being the first person to invent something amazing. And then you say, but maybe you shouldn't benefit from this forever. So this is the opposite of the Disney paradigm in which Disney keeps on magically extending its copyright forever and ever and ever so that they can keep on getting Richard Donald Duck. In sunsetting, that's not supposed to happen. That's supposed to expire. And Donald Duck is supposed to go back in the public domain. And sunsetting is a big phenomenon in the history of infrastructure. So in 18th century Britain, when they start making the roads and then they improve the post system, which was previously something that only aristocrats could afford to use under really exigent circumstances, it was expensive and slow and irregular. After 1785, the post system is standardized and they have standardized horse-drawn carriages departing on time, arriving at time, punctuated by a special bugle call and special carriages. Okay, so they've got the post coach system is regularized. One of the components that makes the regularization of the post office possible is a map. And the map has all of the information about which roads to use and which roads usually don't get plowed for snow, how long it takes to use different road systems. And that road is compiled by a man named John Carey. And he does it at the request and getting paid by the post office. But in return for compiling that map, he also gets a copyright on it for 20 years, during which he gets to be the only person who sells the map of Britain, which is correlated with the postcoach system. So he gets to sell it from London, and does this make him a lot of money? Yes, it makes him a lot of money. And then the copyright goes away, and then everybody else can make maps, and then maps become super cheap. And maps become something that you can get printed on a handkerchief or cheap paper edition. And we have travel maps for the first time, which is a big innovation. Because maps used to be like this huge, heavy volume that you would keep on your coffee table and never move because it was heavy and expensive, and there were only a couple of them. So maps become cheap and popular because Carey's copyright expires. So maybe that's a good metaphor. Okay, so we have hardcore libertarianism, we have sunsetting, we also have severing. So in severing, you say, this thing that we thought was one piece of infrastructure is actually two pieces of infrastructure. Let's pull these apart. So the railways, the private railway companies build some railroads and then they have cars. And the way it used to work is that the railroad company cars go on the railway system. But then what if you want to do a cross-country travel? Then you have to use multiple rail systems. What if you have one set of cars or you don't want to unload it when you have to get on another set of rails? So you decouple those. You sever the different interests and you say, the private rails are going to be held in common and the cars are going to be separate. So think about the way this works today. Taxi cabs are private companies. Every cab driver has a medallion and they are completely different than the public entity that paves the road. If it didn't work that way, it would be extremely confusing and you wouldn't have nearly the independence or freedom to operate or to create Uber. Okay, so you can sever the different resources. You can sunset the rights. You can sever the rights. And then the fourth perspective that's really crucial is maybe the oldest of them all, and that's owning things in common. And what we know, of course, thanks to the research of Eleanor Ostrom, is that owning things in common doesn't mean that it's a free-for-all. It doesn't mean that Garrett Hardin is right and it's a tragedy of the commons because everybody's going to bring their cow and graze in the commons. No. Commons have rules. There are rules about who can participate. There are rules about what you do when you participate. So think of the highway as a commons. Not everybody can drive their car. You have to get a driver's license. You have to have your wagon license so it's not going to break down. That's one of the first things. Did you know that in the 18th century there were driver's license and license plates on wagons? There were. It's an ancient institution because you have to protect your commons as soon as you have it. So you can have a commons type system, which is run on behalf of the public. And in the modern world, we tend to assign states, public entities to run that with accredited forms of experts like engineers. If you're going to be a civil engineer and work on the road system, you have to pass a state-appointed exam and get your engineering stamp. Otherwise, they don't let you near it because you don't know all of the functions and the bridge you build over the highway system could fall down. We have many, many, many checks on the driver, on the car, on the engineer who builds the bridge, on who gets to do the engineering before you can go anywhere near the interstate highway system, and then it serves everybody. So hardcore libertarianism, sunsetting, severing, and common systems are four of the approaches that we can use to approach public infrastructure. And so, you know, to return back to the question that started this conversation, the Google Index, we see that the Google Index is built upon the data collected by a public entity, which is Wikipedia, and then the Google Index advances that somewhat. Is that, do we think like hardcore libertarians that Google, well done, way for being innovative, you should get to keep all of your profits? It sounds like an argument that I might make if I were a corrupt entity. Like if I had a lot of Google stock, I might make that argument. Do you believe in sunsetting? Like, okay, so Google helped to make Wikipedia indexed, and that was a good thing, but you get to do that for 5 years, 10 years, and then that index needs to return to the public so other people can build on top of it. Can it be severed, as in Google's map of Wikipedia or Google's index of websites in general can be severed somehow from a different part of the data structure? And maybe this is where Brent's computer science might help us to understand what that severing would look like. Or is it all one big commons and we need some public entity to come in and mediate this and say only accredited computer scientists can create data structures? I don't even know what that would look like in this case. But what is the commons? Is the index itself a commons? Is Wikipedia looks a lot like a commons that's made by the hands of many, but not everyone can make an edit to a web page. You have to be accredited and you have to go through many, many checkpoints before you can edit the page on the Holy Bible. You can't just say, no, I believe that Zenon gave us the earth.
So can I try to put a gloss on that and you can tell me if I'm getting it wrong?
Yes.
So it seems like there, you know, when we think about those different approaches, so on the first three approaches are all different variations of basically locking things private or locking them open. So in other words, the libertarian approach is everything is private property. Everything is, you know, fully proprietarian control over whatever. The sunsetting and the severing approaches are limits on that proprietarian approach. So in other words, we have, things are private until they're not, and then they're open. And the fourth approach, the sort of common ownership approach, to me, that what that's doing is that is exploring the territory between those two ends of the spectrum. So there, on one end of the spectrum, we have locked private. And the other end of the spectrum, we have locked open. And there's this whole territory in between them, which is what Ostrom is exploring, and which is really what the entire idea of governance, basically, like that whole subject matter, to me, is exploring that space in between locked private and locked open. And there's tremendous richness within that. But yeah, to me, I'm really interested in governance, basically. I'm interested in that space in between those two things, because as I signaled before, like I kind of think Wikipedia, by locking itself open, is great in a way, it can do great things, but it can also be a mistake because it can allow things to get appropriated. So in other words, if all of the value in the world was just laying out there open for anybody to pick up, then it would be like whoever has the biggest vacuum cleaner to vacuum it all up will end up vacuuming it all up, which is what people worry about with, you know, data processing and AI effectively.
Yes. I think that's right, Matt. Let me just add one more provocation that I think I think in the world, if I think about, you know, people who are coming and going from Silicon Valley, I think, there's an appreciation for these different modes in a very general sense. If you're somebody who is engaged with the debate about Creative Commons, then you know what I'm talking about share and share alike licenses. If you're somebody who uses the R repository, the CRAN repository, then you're used to finding code which is held like a commons, managed like a commons, and is often rationalized in a way in which Python isn't because of the CRAN repository. One of the things that we're not really good at thinking about right now is the question raised by LaDonya, quien me paga? Who's going to pay me? Who is going to pay me for doing this work? In the world of open source software and even open source maps or Wikipedia, it's presumed that you have a world of voluntary effort. Now think back again to the interstate highway system. Those engineers, those civil engineers who were improving the roads are not doing that out of the goodness of their heart or because they're video gamers and they've taken this on as a quest for knowledge, or it's their private art practice, or it's a hobby or anything else. They're doing it for pay. And they're doing it for pay essentially because civil engineers were very clever and they unionized early on. They didn't call it a union. They called it the Royal Society of Civil Engineers. They did it old school. They asked the Queen to bless it. So it's not strictly a union. It's a little bit more hoity-toity. And that means that they have a journal and a conference. That's the only difference between a union and a Royal Society so far as I'm concerned. A journal and a conference and the Queen blesses you. But otherwise, it's a union because you all stick together and you say, we have to get paid. You have to do certain things to be a member of us and then we get paid. So one of the reasons why this question about the index is so important and how the index is imagined, is it going to sunset, is it going to sever, is it a commons, you want to imagine a world in which the people who are improving the index or improving the index via Wikipedia or OSM are somehow getting compensated for the work. And at the moment, the only way for anybody to get compensated is by working for Google. So, if I step back for a moment, and, I'm open to other interpretations, but if I, step back and I think, well, what's going to happen? Well, the reason why you want the state involved with roads, and the state wasn't involved for, 100 years before the state starts improving the post office. And the reason why you want the state involved is that the state is very good at saying, okay, fine, we'll hire people and we'll pay them. We'll pay them what they tell us to pay them. So it's the state that hires the civil engineers after years and years of private entities hiring whoever they hired. So if you want to imagine the next iteration of what happens if an index is a public vehicle for anybody to build a search engine on, then you need a state or a state-like entity that would be like a mega nonprofit, a mega Wikipedia corporation, to say, okay, we really care about making sure that good data is available. And we're going to do this. We're going to hire people who are really good at this job, and we're going to hire them at the right rates, and we're going to continue to build and sustain and maintain and even improve upon this public infrastructure. Now, what would make them do this? Right now, I mean, you'd have to be a crazy zealot on behalf of the commons. I mean, like me, but I don't have any money. You'd have to be a crazy zealot in order to make that happen. What historically, the only reason why you've gotten the birth of civil engineering is that you have some sector of underserved people who are not being served very well by the way the infrastructure was set up, who say, it's nice that you have roads over there in that half of the country, but over here in Wales, we can't get to the market. Over here in Ireland, we're stuck here for good. You know what would be awesome? If you connected Ireland to the rest of Britain, connected Scotland to the rest of Britain. How about people like us? And remember, in the 18th century, these are racial categories. I don't know, guys. We're all well-educated here. Is there anybody in America who is not being served right very well by our broadband infrastructure? have we heard any complaints of that kind over the last decade? I don't know. Any initiatives to collect data about Black Lives Matters or women's experiences? Any complaints whatsoever about Silicon Valley companies? Probably not. Probably everybody's super happy with the way things are paying out. So there's no reason why people would have come together and start to imagine a larger overarching either state entity or independent nonprofit that would pay people to build an infrastructure that really did serve everyone and make the legal case that the index should probably be a public infrastructure, because states have always been very comfortable taking toll roads and taking railroads and taking and taking any maps and any other form of infrastructure and commandeering it for the public good when there were underserved communities who could not be connected to the economy on their own terms.
So Joe, my head is exploding. That was amazing. Thank you. So one thing I want to say is, like, you know, for, you know, anyone who's listening, I think what Joe did there was a fantastic example of something that I get to benefit from through my interdisciplinary, you know, approach to computer science, which is easily understandable, amazing frameworks and knowledge that can help me, you know, orient to provide infrastructure or reference system for some of the challenges that we are facing, and provide an amazing, you know, set of knowledge relationships you know, that can, again, overuse this, can serve as infrastructure for further and deeper collaboration. So that was wonderful. You know, what you just said about infrastructure, what you just said right now in terms of payment infrastructure, it's the Wikimedia Foundation is exactly this, right? So, like, I cut my teeth in computer science doing one part of computer science's first sort of deep look into what we now understand as algorithmic bias. I was trying to understand effectively, like, given that Wikipedia is so important at teaching, you know, it is the way that so many AI systems learn about the world, a way or the way, you know, what are the, you know, long-term, you know, implications, that where is it going to be effective, where is it going to be less effective? And that led to a lot of content bias analyses. And, you know, we know that Wikipedia, we know actually by, if you just look at the different language editions of Wikipedia, you see, like, dramatic differences in what gets covered. So you only can imagine what other differences exist that don't cut across language boundaries, right? So we know that Wikipedia is predominantly edited by men, for instance. So the Wikipedia Foundation is in many ways trying to do this, right? They take, you know, my donation dollars, they take everyone's donation dollars and try to get initiatives going, like hackathons to focus on women scientists and these types of things. Is exactly the dynamic that you're talking about. The concern for, or one concern for us, and one reason we started this work, and we thought about mostly in terms of power structures, but it's exactly what you're discussing, gets me very excited, is that because Wikipedia, the infrastructure is suffering, because Wikipedia gets such a tiny, 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 tiny share of the benefits of the infrastructure that it's building. You know, I think there's an analogy to taxation or something like this, right? Where it's like, if you spend no money on the road, you know, it's going to be a problem. So that was just fascinating. Just fascinating.
I mean, just to follow up on that last thought, I mean, it's true. Like, the civil engineers could have formed a civil engineering foundation analogous to the Wikimedia Foundation when they got started in 1820 and started building roads on their own. The only problem is that all the civil engineers can do on their own is show up with their hat in their hand and say, do you want to pay me to be open? And often the answer is, not right now. I don't see how I don't know why, but the state can decide, well, we're going to pay you to be awesome because we can tax people. If we build something in the name of the common good and it's going to connect all of these populations who weren't previously connected, it's going to satisfy their interests. They're going to become active in the economy in a new way because there's going to be a search engine which isn't implementing racial profiling or gender bias or showing black 10-year-old girls who Google the phrase black girls pornographic images. I mean, that's a terrible thing, right? Once you see that, you can't unsee that. Poor 10-year-old girl. We don't want that on a we don't want that in a good society. Who wants that for our nation or our world? The state can say, I'm going to tax everybody. I'm not going to tax you very much, but I'm going to need a dollar from everybody so that we can build something where when 10-year-old black children Google black girls, they don't see pornography. Great. Okay. So then the Wikimedia Foundation becomes a really important chrysalis for something that could come out of it that would be bigger. I mean, an index of world knowledge, an index of culture. Something that's not just built on AI, but it's built on the actual contributions of human beings, including some of our values, right? And this is, you know, the part of the libertarian fantasy about AI and the way that I take it, and maybe Brent, you can draw this out for me, but part of the fantasy is that the AI is just going to figure that out. It's going to figure out how to think about getting more and it's going to put out our economy and it's going to pay the right people. But, you know, it turns out that the AI sometimes reproduces biases, for example, in the Google search engine. So the Wikimedia Foundation, I think you've done a beautiful job of connecting for us how important the Wikipedia is as a player in the space. What would you imagine if there was, like, you know, a son of Wikipedia, a daughter of Wikipedia, the Wikimedia Foundation, that got really big, like a UN, the UN marries Wikipedia? What would that look like?
You know, that's such an interesting question, Joe. And I'd have to make form connections to existing ideas and new ideas, you know, on the fly here. So I'll try to reflect a bit. I'm laughing. You found the wrong computer scientist to defend sort of a libertarian view of, you know, artificial intelligence. You know, that's not going to happen. You know, the views of AI that you encounter when you hear that perspective are views that are heavily rooted in failed abstractions. I'll put it that way, to bring us back to the beginning of the conversation. The thing I want to make one point and then, you know, reflect more broadly on your question. Computer science is so dependent on, you know, this is something I was thinking about, on your holding things in common model. And a lot of what I'm talking about, I mean, we do reflect on this, our research through this lens, is thinking about what's happening through the dynamic of the tragedy of the commons. So let me just like name some sort of holding every, like, things that are in the commons. Oh, there's some complications with some of these that sort of are just essential to everything we do on computers. So, one, of course, everything that happened during World War II with the United States and computation. But we can zoom forward a bit. So the internet was a commons project. GPS was something that the United States developed for military purposes and then made available in a very, like, discreet way to the rest of the entire world, not just the United States, as infrastructure to support any application that involves spatial referencing. So Google Maps, everything is hugely dependent on that investment by United States taxpayers. Now, increasingly also taxpayers from other countries too, who are setting up their own systems. Wikipedia, we already mentioned, tons and tons of open source code, all these things come from the commons. And I think it's important that we in computing recognize how tied we are to that model, if only to provide an altruistic incentive and other related incentives to encourage us not to behave in ways that will damage the commons. You know, with respect to what a Wikimedia Foundation might look like that takes on these types of this type of broad role, but again, I'd say it actually is serving this capacity. It's just under resourced. You know, something that does come to mind, and this has all sorts of interesting downsides. But you know, we literally have a research paper that, you know, with respect to the road example, showed that Wikipedia has better quality articles about places in urban areas than in rural areas. And if we're thinking about that data as some kind of infrastructure for, you know, that what that means is all these AI systems have better quality understanding of urban areas than rural areas. So one might think about what are ways that we have served rural areas in the past and try to replicate that. It, you know, that is, you know, very nation-based, but you know, I'm again sort of thinking out loud here. One could imagine a Department of Data Infrastructure. I mean, it built it off the census because the census kind of already, has been a world leader in many cases, you know, in providing other types of data infrastructure that does try to create, actually, come to think of it, the census does make up the bulk of many rural Wikipedia articles. It's a template generated from census data. So maybe they can write a little bit about the history and you know, these types of things as well. Thinking out loud, I don't see too many differences in that relative to like doing the public works projects that happened in the 30s and arts funding, you know, and these types of things. So that's, you can imagine sort of a state actor that is participating in these sort of knowledge infrastructure communities, OpenStreetMap, Wikipedia, many others you can imagine as well. And that would fuel a ton of innovation and making sure that innovation is then taxed or the resources flow back into the state to make sure that everyone's benefiting from it.
I'll just throw out three more quick references just to bring things around. The history of reaching out to rural communities, absolutely rural free delivery for the U.S. Post Office was a big deal. Rural electrification was, of course, part of the New Deal. Those were the first, it's amazing to think about it. You know, it seems like everybody has electricity, but if you were hanging out in, in rural Alabama in 1930, it did not seem like everybody had electricity. It seemed like that innovation was never, ever, ever going to get to rural people like you until the government stepped in. For studies of how algorithms have and indexes at the moment jeopardize Black communities, that Googling Black Girls anecdote that I pulled out is from Sophia Noble. Her book, Algorithms of Oppression, is a must read on how Google's and so on data could be structured otherwise. It hasn't been structured anyway otherwise, in part because the institutions have not been incentivized to serve all communities. I mean, just think about those rural communities and communities of color as being on the same page. They're underserved. And then I would add to that Lauren Klein and Catherine D'Ignacio's book, Data Feminism, as bringing in the question of data literacy and women's participation in these knowledge infrastructures as third and the required reading. Matt, what else do you have for us? What else should we talk about?
Well, I'd like to suggest a thought complementary to what you were just saying, Joe, which is that I think that one of the, so I'm going to risk, you know, bringing in a more sort of legal or political lens here, because I think that sometimes when we think about institutions that are in the position of governance of infrastructure, we have this tendency to talk a lot about how they're incentivized. In other words, are they incentivized to serve all the right people? There's another word that kind of gets at the same thing, which is how are they legitimated? And I think this is sort of an under-examined angle. So in other words, when we think about, you know, the source of the legitimacy of a government's power is legitimated through the sort of social fabric, right? In other words, it's just like, it's like bubbling up through the social fabric. And this is why the apparatus itself is like constituted by the social fabric. And so it's therefore legitimated in the right way. And then if we think about a private institution, right, the legitimacy of the power that a private institution wields is just fiated, right? It is just an abstraction. We just say that private institutions are able to do whatever they want with what they own, because that's what it means to own things. And what you're suggesting, Joe, about, you know, the Wikimedia Foundation, or a lot of the work that doing at Radical Exchange about thinking about these kinds of other sorts of intermediate civil society type organizations, relates to this. It relates to this idea that there's a kind of public flavored power that can sort of pervade society, which isn't necessarily state power, but it can be like the kind of power that unions exercise, or the kind of power that, you know, publicly responsible nonprofits like Wikimedia Foundation might exercise. And that sort of power is legitimated in a different way than the power of private organizations. And I think that it's simply the other side of the same coin. But I think that language and that analysis is a really important complement to the language of incentives.
That's helpful, Matt. And could you just help to connect that for us? I take it to be saying that the legitimation behind the Wikimedia Foundation gives it more recognizable moral purpose in our world. Is there a way in which you can connect that to taxation and the compensation of labor that would build a different kind of index? Can you help us to see that?
Well, you know, the government has the power of taxation because, you know, if and only if it is a legitimate government, right? Otherwise, the taxation is illegitimate. And, similarly, organizations like unions exercise whatever power they exercise if and only if they are legitimate. And this is inescapably sort of a philosophical inquiry about the nature of whatever institution we're talking about. I don't know whether Wikimedia Foundation, you know, I think it's beyond the scope here to talk about whether Wikimedia Foundation could levy taxes. I mean, you know, no, but there are, you see what I mean. Like, I think that we do need to be a little bit more creative about the kind of power that we want organizations like Wikimedia Foundation or like unions or whatever to exercise, instead of getting stuck in this dichotomy of state power on the one hand and narrowly defined private power on the other.
I mean, fair enough. A union says we've got to raise wages. The company has to be the one to raise the wages. And then the union officers are going to get a cut so that the union survives. So part of what Brent has been hinting out here is a wider role for the Wikipedia Foundation. Perhaps one in which big Silicon Valley compensates Wikimedia Wikipedia and Wikipedians for their work? Is that something that we might, that people are actively imagining, Brent?
Yes, actually, there's news today where they the foundation, and we've, you know, like a full disclosure, we've had conversations with them. One of my former graduate students works at the Wikimedia Foundation. So, you know, take what I'm saying with that grain of salt. And I have to learn about the final decisions that are associated with the announcement today. But they did launch a paid API for enterprises to consume the information. And I should stop there because I need the facts before I form the opinion. But I can't say for sure is I'm glad they're thinking about ways to make sure that they have the resources they need to keep the infrastructure moving along and you know, up to date and very, very high quality. You know, Matt, I actually think I'm, you know, when maybe a nice bow tie for us is that actually this term legitimating, right, is one that perhaps it describes my research pretty well. When I say we want to measure and make people aware of the value they're bringing to AI technologies through the data that they create, in many ways, we're saying you are legitimate stakeholders right. in this ecosystem. You have more power than you think, right? And so there are certain actions that are legitimized when you understand you have that power. That aren't legitimized when you don't, right? So, you know, this is old news for you, Matt, but we talk about these techniques called like conscious data contribution, right? Where you can be very careful about where you decide to send the data that you generate and don't like the frame of your data for a number of reasons, one of which is some of the most valuable data that we all create for AI systems isn't at all about us, it's about the world. And Wikipedia is a great example of that. But yeah, this notion of effectively, like, if we can legitimate some of these institutions, like what Joe is talking about, whether that is this legitimating the state's involvement in these matters, or other institutions, so like some of the intermediaries that you're talking about. I was actually thinking we should tell them all to launch a society and talk to the queen and call them, or to launch a journal, talk to the queen, we can all call them societies. whether it's those types of organizations or the state itself, I think that's ultimately maybe what we're talking about is the people outside the tech companies have legitimate power over these infrastructures in ways that maybe, you know, aren't commonly known. And one thing we're trying to do is make sure that folks understand that and give them the tools they need to take that legitimate action.
Are there concrete steps? I mean, if I was a dissatisfied employee of a large search engine company who had volunteered my labor, are there steps that I could take to help my employer to see that I am part of the force that legitimates their success?
So employees are a different set of stakeholders. I think we're actually, I'm optimistic about what I'm seeing with regards to their understanding of their power in the ecosystem. And this aligns, you know, I think it was Matt Iglesias or something who alerted me to the notion that probably tech employees are the ones who would benefit most from a union because there's so much leverage there. These are the paid employees. Actually, one thing I do in keynotes when I talk about this type of, you know, this general subject is I actually printed out fake badges and like just hand them out to people. It's like, you are actually employees of all these companies because of, we talked about Wikipedia, but when you search for something, you click on the seventh link instead of the first link. Well, you're doing a lot of you're teaching the search engine a lot of what it knows about how to do relevance ranking. so everyone's an employee with regard to that. That's where, you know, Matt Nick Vincent's work is headed, which is thinking about how can we build a language and a framework and a set of tools to help people take collective action. So you can imagine someone like that. It's like, say, you know, I'm fed up. I'm going to stop reviewing things on Amazon. And I really want Amazon to recognize that this is a collective enterprise and that I have legitimate power in sort of saying, Amazon, you should change your privacy rights. You should pay these taxes, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So Nick has identified sort of three types of collective action strategies. There's the data strike, where you organize a bunch of people to stop interacting with Amazon and rating and reviewing products. That one, you know, we sort of understand the statistical properties of machine learning and how effective and how big that would need to be. That one would have to be pretty big, but it would be pretty damaging. Another thing that you can do is you can engage in conscious data contribution. So you help stand up a competitor. And that's actually, we haven't talked about common crawl yet, which we probably should, given that we're talking about web indices. Common crawl is in some ways an effort to do that. But in the open, you can also imagine giving it to another private company. So for instance, you're frustrated with Google Maps or Bing Maps, you give your site, I'm just going to review for Yelp or vice versa. And then the third option is pretty interesting. It's a data poisoning. And in that case, you sort of poison the commons. commons, that's much more complicated. So we should leave that aside. That one has a lot of discussion associated with it. You can poison the data that you submit to these private repositories. So for instance, poisoning the submission to Google Maps, you know, in the way that, you know, I was describing earlier, such that, you know, people will go in loops forever or something like this. That's another way to sort of take action and let folks know that your power is legitimate and that, you know, you should be listened to.
Well, thank you guys so much. This was an amazing conversation. We got a ton of good thinking and talking done. So super grateful for your time.
Matt, Joe, that was really fun. Joe, you taught me a bunch. I'm going to be noodling on what you just said for a while and excitedly talking to my PhD students about it and these types of things. So thank you.
Likewise, I'm going to be scratching my head about data strikes and data poisoning for some time. This is great. And I feel like I feel like we could easily do another follow-up conversation about other themes and infrastructure sometime. Matt, let's scratch our head about another time to hang out with Brent. Brent, I know that you're super, super busy, but this was too much fun to not do it again.
It was tons of fun. That went by super quickly. Thanks, Matt, for putting us together.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to Brent and Joe. That conversation was a huge pleasure for me. Thank you to everyone supporting Radical Exchange Foundation. This wouldn't be possible without your support. You can continue to support us at radicalexchange.org. Thank you also to the producers of Radical Exchanges, Jennifer Marone, Leon Erickson, and join us again soon, and have a great weekend.